Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 136, recorded September 8th, 2011, Overclocking Battlefield 3.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit.
Welcome to this week's edition of Where in the World Are Ryan and Patrick, starring Patrick Norton and Ryan Shrout. Actually, it's This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by the inimitable benchmarking madman who has been suffering for your knowledge gain this week, Mr. Ryan Shrout. You were hurt earlier this week.
I've had a lot of technical issues with some hardware in here that we are trying to address and fix, mostly with trying to do some pretty new and interesting and exciting things in the worlds of benchmarking, but nobody really makes the equipment to do what I want to do, like capture video at 2560 by 1600, capture it from a computer to an external computer at 60 frames per second. Apparently, it takes a lot of processing power. It takes a very sophisticated, very expensive capture card and very fast codecs in terms of being able to write all that data at one time. So
that's pretty out of control, dude. That's like
it is like it's writing literally like 300 megabytes a second of data. So here's one of those instances where we say, you know, owning a PCI Express based SSD for this system will be a worthwhile venture.
Yeah, at least if you could data back off of it onto right. Your much larger storage device really quickly.
Now, I noticed something odd here, Patrick, today. I am at home. You are not. And this is a turnaround from normal, although it seems to be most weeks one or the other of us is out of town. So
that's where that's what had me laughing at the beginning of the show. It's like, where in the world are Ryan and Patrick this week? I'm in Lakeview, Oregon.
Okay.
Taking a rifle class up at Thunder Ranch. You can probably see my hat.
Nice.
And basically, like, demoed a bathroom, drove up to Oregon last night, and sat out in the hot Oregon sun most of the day. Learning how to basically map out the ballistics of my rifle. It's very exciting. I will share my glorious big hunt results with you.
Not that I'm awesome. Awesome.
I don't even know where to go with the Mars 2 combo. $4,000. The Asus X58 Mars 2 Extreme Gaming Super Combo. Because I keep looking at this and thinking, like, you know, because it all seems so innocuous. $230 for a case. $600 for the Black Edition motherboard.
Which is not necessarily innocuous at all, really.
No. And then $1,500. Well, you should walk people out. First of all, I mean, this is like one of those $10,000 cell phones made by Virtu, that motherboard.
Well, kind of. So we talked about the Asus Mars 2 card and what an awesome gaming card it was and how ridiculously expensive it was at $1,499. Even though it was limited edition, blah, 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 that type of stuff. It was by far the fastest graphics card, single graphics card we'd ever tested. And at $1,499, you think that's crazy. But it turns out you can't even buy that by itself. The two places that sell it, Newegg and NCIX, are actually making you, this is probably, you know, a good purchasing tactic, more or less. You know, they're making you buy a bunch of other stuff along with it to the tune of $4,108.99 worth of hardware. So basically a complete system, a really high-end system, but a complete system nonetheless. You mentioned a $230 Raven case, the Rampage 3 Black Edition motherboard, which for a $560 motherboard is like way out there from what we would normally recommend on this show. $280 power supply, $1,000 processor, you know, the Gulftown 6-core, Core i7-990X Extreme Edition part. This is all really kind of crazy high-end stuff.
Well, it's also funny because, like, 6-cores are currently kind of useless for gaming. Great for rendering, great for encoding media, Yeah. The motherboard, I mean, the motherboard is the new black. It's basically a $200 motherboard in $600 worth of clothing, or am I just missing the awesomeness of it?
So I think this motherboard actually comes with, high-end Zonar sound card that also has Bigfoot networking card in it, whether or not you put any value on that. It has a lot of overclocking capability and those types of things. I mean, it's probably the most expensive motherboard for a desktop consumer single processor platform that I know of. But, you know, it's got Bluetooth version 3. This is also
for the discerning gamer whose budgets are matched only by their need for expensive hardware their neighbors won't have.
Right. And that's why I think it kind of makes sense. Because if you were considering a $1,500 video card,
right,
you're that kind of guy already or that kind of girl already, right? So on one hand, it's kind of like, it's kind of annoying because there are people that maybe would want to buy this, but not all those other components. Maybe they already have a high-end processor and a high-end motherboard and that type of thing. So it's kind of annoying for those people. But it's hard to feel bad for those people anyway.
Right? Yeah, no, I SSD decoder has been updated in much more sort of wholesome news.
Version 4.0, as Alan is calling it, at pcper.com/SSD. If you have any questions necessarily, if you have any ideas, thoughts, maybe you're trying to figure out which SSDs all use that same SandForce controller that you've heard so much about. If you go to pcper.com/SSD and open up the decoder, it opens up in a brand new window. It's basically a huge searchable table of information, including manufacturers, chip vendors, those types of things. It'll let you know, let's say the first example, SandForce 2281 chipset from Corsair. They make two models of that, the Force Series 3 and Force Series GT. It tells you whether they're using MLC or SLC, what capacities are available, what the exact part numbers available, and what the specified read and write speeds are, whether or not they support TRIM, those types of things, although most of them do at this point. But it is... The decoder has basically doubled in size. It has tons of information, lots of links to our reviews if they exist. So, you know, there's a lot of information here. And I know a lot of our readers and a lot of our viewers have a lot of questions about solid-state drives. We get them all the time. Which one should I pick? Which one should I pick? Which ones are similar? This will help you kind of wade through a lot of that information, I think.
You don't have the lovely Alan Maldovando's phone number on speed dial. He offers you the decoder update. It's actually
this is the next best option.
And probably more practical than calling him on the phone at 2 in the morning when you're browsing for your next SSD.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that, actually. So you had a note in here about 4-terabyte hard drives, Seagate shipping external drives, and then Hitachi rolls out 8-terabyte drives, kind of. I had not heard about this. What is the new here?
Okay, so Seagate ships the world's first 4-terabyte external hard disk drive. We assume it is a single disk 4-terabyte hard drive. A year after they introduced the first 3-terabyte external hard drive. You know, of course, internal 3-terabyte hard drives now selling for $125 on sale. And then literally the next day, Hitachi releases an announcement. Turns out they've got a terabyte per platter, no problem. And the register says... where is it? Hitachi GST. The day after Seagate launched its 4-terabyte external drive, Hitachi GST did exactly the same with its launch of a 4-terabyte desktop Whopper. And they announced their 4-terabyte product in the shape of a, quote, twin drive 8-terabyte G-RAID Thunderbolt Exchange, external storage product designed specifically for the Mac market.
Wow.
So 7,200 RPM 4-terabyte drives. Running over the Thunderbolt. So finally, a reason for you to be excited about the Thunderbolt on your new Mac.
No? If you have it, I guess. Right. I don't have any systems that have Thunderbolt connectivity yet, so I'm still kind of waiting to be excited about all the Thunderbolt accessories that are coming out.
The Register article quotes the... Hitachi is saying, to excite video editing professionals further, Hitachi says every terabyte can hold 84 hours of HDV 1080i, 17 hours of DVC Pro HD 1080 60i, 30 hours of 2K Red, 10 hours of ProRes 422 HQ, 10 hours of 10-bit SD, and 2.5 hours of HD 1080/60i. That's a narrow market.
It is a very specific niche field, is it not?
you know, you're actually probably on the short list for that, trying to capture gigantic screens in real time.
Yeah, we're looking at 480 gig PCI Express based solid state drives for each individual capture, and then moving that off to multi terabyte drives after that. So yes, we are unfortunately on that side, and I say unfortunate because those are also the expensive sides of things. A few weeks ago, when I was in, go ahead.
I was saying, like, 2 weeks after I buy a power supply with a fan, you torture me.
Yes. In my defense, I told you this was coming. I believe a few weeks ago when we were both at the Twit Brick House doing the show there, I mentioned we had on cue a Kingwind 500-watt fanless power supply review. And we have posted that over the last week. Lee Garbutt posted that up, completely passive, air-cooled, 500-watt continuous power, and quote-unquote overclockable to 600 watts with a little bit of adjustment. Fanless, 0 decibel rating, obviously. It is 80-plus platinum certified with up to 92% efficiency. I guess that's kind of a side effect of being completely passive and needing to be able to have components that run without air running across them. It even supports SLI and Crossfire, which really? I don't know if that maybe kind of goes outside the bounds of use case for a passively cooled power supply. You know, I don't know many people who are going to want a silent power supply, but then hook up two GTX 570s to their system, right? Maybe
your boss that said you have to support this feature.
That might have been as well.
But it's pretty, I mean, it's amazing. Kingwind's been doing some really nice power supplies, getting a lot of props in the last year. What was the pricing on it?
$129, $159. So it is kind of expensive, rather expensive for a 500-watt unit, but you are paying for, you know, 80-plus platinum doesn't really exist on a lot of power supplies. So you're paying for that efficiency, and you are paying for those higher-end components that are required to run no airflow, basically, through this unit. So it's expensive for a 500-watt, but it's probably the best passively cooled power supply in its kind of price range. We were basically pretty impressed with it. Silent operation, great efficiency, up to 600 watts of actual usage, good voltage regulation, clean DC outputs, those types of things. The only weakness that Lee found in it was the quote premium price of $160. So, but it did get a gold award. So that's a good sign, I guess, if you are one of those silent computing, quiet computing noise freaks.
Silence is platinum, and it costs big bucks. Speaking of big bucks, what's going on with Ultrabook? Which is Ultrabook just, is it Intel's turn to just fail miserably in public?
It's like this weird hollow drama or something like that between Intel and its partners, right? So we talk, it seems we come up with something different every week where we're finally able to get the prices down. Intel says they can. Its partners say there's not possible to get our prices to that low. Now there's a couple of new things that happened in the last week. One is there's going to be limited availability of all of these notebooks. According to DigiTimes, every single Intel Ultrabook partner is limiting their initial runs to under 50,000 units worldwide. So if you like that new Acer, you like that new, what was the other one that was just announced this week? Lenovo, Toshiba, Asus has one. They're all apparently limiting it to 50,000 units in their first run. So, what's that?
I was going to say, buy it now if you want it, because it's not going to be. Well, actually, they're either not going to be available in a month, or they're going to be really cheap in a month.
I was afraid of the opposite. I was afraid that these vendors that sell these machines like Newegg are going to find out that they're limited, that people are very interested in them, and raise prices over that kind of targeted $999 street price. It's unfortunate that that is one of the side effects. Also, news this week is that apparently, because of the pricing considerations and all the issues that people have had, the OEMs and vendors specifically on this, is that they're potentially getting rid of the metal chassis, like the magnesium and the aluminum alloys that they've seen in some of these pre-production designs that have really kind of made the MacBook Air get a lot of the attention that it got originally. It's just how it looked, and replacing it with fiberglass and plastic materials in order to bring that price down. I'm kind of interested in the fiberglass idea. I don't know if I like the idea of dropping my laptop and watching it shatter into 1,000 pieces.
Fiberglass doesn't shatter, actually. Fiberglass, if properly created, is unbelievably... People sail in horrible, horrible storms in fiberglass boats quite safely. Fiberglass is a fantastic material. I don't know if it's as...
Glass are with old kit cars, and those are not positive ones.
No, but they've learned a lot, and Intel's engineers are better than most of the ones that were working on kit cars in the 60s. I don't know. Thunderbolt's a mess. I would also like to publicly apologize. Ultrabook's kind of a mess, and I would like to apologize to Thunderbolt, the interface, because just yesterday I was thinking it's reducing parts count, it's reducing Z. I think USB 3.0 is going to be more popular. And then I see the ultimate, if it ever ships, the ultimate cool thing to do with Thunderbolt, which is Magva's 3-slot Thunderbolt expansion chassis, which I didn't entirely get till I saw the picture. And I thought PCI Express cards to a notebook over Thunderbolt. This is the first time I've ever actually been impressed by Thunderbolt. Will it ever ship?
Having never heard of this company before, I'm tempted. My default, if I had to put money on it today, I would say no. But I am fairly confident that somebody will make a product like this and ship it before the end of the year, even if it's not this company. So they're saying it will be available for pre-order in Q4, MSRP of under $1,000, which probably means $999, which is really, really kind of steep for what this is. But you're right. This is kind of what Thunderbolt, when before that, when it was called, what the hell was it called before it was called Thunderbolt?
Lightwave, Dance Beam.
There we go. Light Peak. That's what it was. The idea of extending the PCI Express bus outside of a machine, whether or not it be a desktop or a laptop, sounded like a good idea. So we're talking about 10 gigabits per second of bandwidth, which is like 1.5, 1.25 gigabytes per second of bandwidth available to these cards. And it's 3 slots. So you could potentially put, a 10 gigabit network cards out there. There, boom. Now you can install those on your MacBook Pro. High-end PCI Express solid-state drive storage. As long as you don't want to go over that 1 gigabyte per second type of bandwidth limit, you can and do those. And although they don't mention specifically in their documentation about this, it's what about external graphics cards? We get those questions all the time. How can we get external graphics cards on a notebook? Thunderbolt is not specifically made for that, but it's a perfect example of what can happen when you just take a simple, basic interface technology like PCI Express and make it extensible to outside the box, right? So you just basically, if you could, plug in a graphics card into this box, plug it into your MacBook Pro, or maybe say a Windows machine that has Thunderbolt, it just shows up as a PCI Express device. You install drivers for it. You can use it in theory. And that's really, really kind of a powerful and, I think, important transition for this type of market. So now we really get into that whole idea of where you can have your notebook, you can have your laptop that's got a powerful processor, no need for external discrete graphics or anything like that. But when you're at home, you can use the same machine for video editing. You can use the same machine for 3 or 4 panel display output. As long as you have a device, something like this, maybe not specifically this, but something like this to do that with. So I think I'm impressed by this technology, by this product, even if we never see this specific one and I never want to pay $1,000 for it.
Yeah, it's a lot of money for a fancy external chassis. You are having another contest at PCPer.com.
Yes. So we don't have the actual page up at PCPer.com yet, but if you go to bit.ly/PCPerDrobo, all one word, you will see a form to enter in to win. We're going to give away 2 Drobos over the next month and a half or so. And apparently I get to pick which Drobos they are as long as they're consumer models. So Drobo FS, Drobo S, whichever ones, I guess the winner wants to select, 4-bay, those types of things. So we always talk about backing up on this show. We always talk about external storage, offsite storage, away from your computer storage, all these types of things. Drobos are great options for backups. And, we use them. I actually have one at the house and I have one here at the office too that, is going to be part of that transitional system to get 400 gigs worth of data off every day. So we're going to have more details on it on the website in a little bit, but just as kind of a preview, since I wanted to give people who watch and listen to this week in computer hardware. A little heads up. It's bit.ly/PCPerDrobo, all one word. You can go there and enter in that contest. So we'll thank Drobo for their support there. But we'll have more on that probably later in the coming weeks. So I guess, well, it's time for some questions, but I guess we need to thank a sponsor first this week, don't we?
Let's thank Netflix.
Let's do thank Netflix. Netflix is the, I hope they're proud at least, sponsor of this week's episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which saves you time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies on your TV or on your Mac, PC, or iPad with the new iPad app. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones out there as well. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV that way. If you're not a gamer, you can still watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV or a device like a Roku box. You know, they're easy to set up, relatively inexpensive, and easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of those devices, plus there are other ones out there, so keep your eyes open. And you can begin watching a movie. This is actually a really cool feature. Begin watching a movie or show in one room, one location, whatever, and then finish it on a different one. So if you're in the middle of watching, you know, a new episode of one of the series that you want to watch, and maybe that, then you got to get up, you got to go on a plane, you got to travel somewhere. You know, you get to your hotel room. You've got a couple of hours to kill. You can immediately pick up where you left off and start the next episode from there as well. Very cool. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and as many TV shows as you want, anytime you want. And as Patrick will tell you, you can watch repeat episodes as well. And if for whatever reason you're not satisfied, you can cancel at any time. But I think you'll be pretty happy with the services and options you get there. So try Netflix today for 30 days, completely, absolutely free. Go to netflix.com/twit, T-W-I-T. Be sure to use that URL when you sign up for your free trial. netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix.
Thank you, Netflix. I love Netflix. In fact, I will be firing up later on in my hotel room.
That's right. You are in the not a proverbial hotel room. You are in the hotel room looking for something to do before you go to sleep.
Before I go to sleep, which is going to probably, hopefully, be after the podcast. Not that I'm not excited, just that I've been at 90 degree heat at 5,000, 6,000 feet all day today. My brain is demoisturized.
Understandable.
Like Vegas demoisturized. Speaking of which, just to make an awkward transition, Kelly has had that bad, bad popping sound we all know and hate. Or maybe you don't know and hate, but Ryan and I certainly do.
I definitely do.
Kelly writes that I have mentioned before that I have a HP Blackbird 002. I do too, says Kelly. The other day it shut off. There was a pop and then a burning smell from the power supply, which is unusual because usually it's the motherboard that goes, oh, wait. I bet that a power supply went too. Kelly replaced the power supply with one similar to the original model, but the system does not detect the hard drive anymore. I don't think they are getting power. I'm a novice. Correctly, is there a common mistake people make in these situations? This is an enormously difficult. I don't know if you can pull up a picture of the HP Blackbird 002. I'll put a link into that one. It is a really interesting machine. It's like a cast aluminum frame.
Well, it's an awesome case.
It's an awesome case. I actually gave both of mine to Lauterbach because I kept having to. Well, I work on a system at home, and then I bring it back into the office, and these cases weigh 70 delete expletive pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, they are brutally heavy. And yeah. There we go. There's all the pictures of them. So part of what's – it's a – if we can make that a little bigger part of it's it's just like, so if you look over,
not squint,
sorry. Well, basically you can see it's really cool, right? So this is giant, you know, cast aluminum frame around a steel frame with subdivided areas for cooling. It had water cooling built in. And if you mouse over to the right side, there's sort of a series of vertical, horizontal or crescents on the right side. That's the back plane that handles like 1, 2, perfect. 3, 4, 5 hard drives. I had a what turned out to be a motherboard dying, but I thought was the hard drives dead. that entire wiring system runs behind all that plastic. If you ever have a cable, like a wire fry inside one of these machines, you're going to spend the rest of your life putting it back together. The motherboards in these machines were prone to failure, or at least in the one I had. Like Newegg had a 50% fail rate on these motherboards. It just Asus had a bad run of motherboards. Mm-hmm. Most of them went into these incredibly expensive and incredibly stylish machines. So, you know, I would start out. I would start out seeing if, you know, one, make sure you have everything corrected correctly. Like, make sure the SATA drives are all connected. Try doing one SATA drive at a time. To pick one SATA drive, try it on like every SATA port on the motherboard directly with a SATA cable. Then do it for all of the, you know, other, to see whether or not basically it's the motherboard or the hard drives. It's kind of like, you know, it's funny, right? Like, how do you explain the process of painstakingly going through every single possible violation of motherboard and hard drive integrity? Because basically, it's about spending time and plugging things and unplugging things until you decide that, yes, it is completely dead. Yep. Mostly, though, if you have a friend with a, you know, if you're lucky enough to have, like, a SATA adapter for, like, an external SATA adapter or one of those SATA drive adapters, you could, you know, plug that into somebody else's computer, see if they can actually see if the drive spins up. But, you know, yep. If you only have
external hard drive dock could be another option, yeah. If you happen to have like a SATA external USB dock or something like that. There's a good thought.
The real reason that Ryan and I harbor multiple computers, preferably at the same room at the same time, is so that we can use the other computers to troubleshoot the computers that are dead at any given moment or to repair them.
It's like having a parts car, right? You've always got to have something to rip other things out of to test other components with.
I'm having horrible memories about an awful night of lab testing involving dead memory sticks on three different machines. You know, yeah, I would say, Kelly, though, I would basically pick a hard drive, try plugging in each of the SATA slots. Make sure it's spinning up when you turn on the machine. Try the hard drive in somebody else's machine to see if it works. And then start making assumptions about the motherboard being dead or possibly the backplane. If the backplane's dead, you're going to have to learn how to start using a Dremel tool to make space to connect traditional SATA cables to those drives.
All right, let's take an email here from Bill, who's asking about Wi-Fi antenna. He says, I swapped out my router from a G to an N about a year or so ago. My old router had a single antenna, but the new one has three. At one time, I had a laptop that didn't have built-in Wi-Fi, so I used an SMC PCMCIA card with an AirLink directional antenna. I also replaced a single router antenna with a directional antenna, and it worked fine. Now I have the new router with a three antenna and a Droid X that gets poor reception at the opposite end of the house. It's not easy to move the router. I do have a line to a switch in the basement for a NAS about the middle of the house. I don't know enough about RF to know how the three antenna work together. What's an easy way to improve the signal at the other end of the house?
Move it or buy a second router. That's what big corporations do in small offices. Mm-hmm. Or people like me that are becoming increasingly frustrated with 802.11n coverage. There are antennas available. We've actually got a link to one of them on the rundown, macwireless.com. It's weird. I don't find both devices responsive to sort of traditional Wi-Fi hacking.
Right.
That said, some people are very excited about the antennas. It's interesting, over at SmartNet Builder, they're basically saying you need at least a 6 dB antenna to have any noticeable difference, and you'll need three of them. And then you'll either need to directly wire them into the router or find a router that actually supports external antennas, which is getting harder and harder and harder.
Yeah.
You know, I found 802.11n, you know, is the sort of like, you'd say there's 802.11n products that don't work with each other, then there's draft, and there's final. And, you know, I always thought there was going to be increased range, right? Because MIMO, it's multiple input, multiple output, and it's basically using multiple antennas at the receiver and the transmitter. It's a form of smart antenna tech where basically the idea is that you have multiple channels carrying the information to create redundancy or better reception. It's cool. It's amazing math. It's actual gee whiz science. it's also not as easy to make work better in difficult environments as previous technologies. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, like if you have the same level of signal, it should run 2 to 3 times faster than G, but it's not going to go 2 to 3 times farther than G. Ideally you add a second router, maybe in that location in the basement, maybe using power line technology, or figure out a way to move the router. Smallnetbuilder.com, they've got those amazing benchmarks. Maybe you look up your home router and you find out it's dog meat and you upgrade to a significantly improved router in terms of performance and range. They've got some interesting tests where they basically have a set testing environment where they go from like one end of the house to the other, and you can look for the routers that actually deal with that the best.
Now, what do you think about, ironically, we got the same email this week. That's why I put it next in the selection from Spuds. It says, hey guys, I was watching your show from September 1st and you had an email about increasing Wi-Fi signal. You had some great suggestions on purchasing something, but there's another option you have overlooked without existing modifying hardware, cheap hacks. Some cardboard and aluminum foil can do wonders, but the equipment already on hand without violating FCC rules. Check out this video on doing the hack. So he's got a YouTube link there.
That is a remake of a video somebody pulled out of a show I did, posted on their own channel, got like 300,000 views. That's basically, I think I did that the first time on the Screensavers. The windsurfer antenna that the kid in the video is demoing, well, maybe it's a different link. The one I saw was basically, there's interesting stuff you can do, right? There's, you know, boosting transmitting power isn't very helpful. Increasing sensitivity is the most useful thing you can do. Antennas and doing things like parabolic antennas can do things to sort of increase the gathering power of the antenna. Basically, the dB measurement of antenna tells you how directional it is, right? In the ideal physics universe, this is the antenna, this is a point source, and it radiates energy equally in all degrees of the compass and directions of the globe. Like, energy shoots off of it in sort of a spear going out into the cosmos. I'm curious. I haven't had a lot of luck with hacks like this. That's actually a pretty good example of sort of an aluminum foil hack. The idea is you're going to gather more RF for your router. I haven't had a lot of luck with that on 802.11n. And I'd be curious if anybody in the audience has had luck doing any kind of a simple low-end. And I say low-end because they're cheap. You know what I mean? Like some of the parabolic reflectors, it's like 15 minutes of your time, a printout, you know, an old manila folder, and some aluminum foil. So for, 20 minutes and, 20 minutes of work and like 10 cents in materials, you could actually have a significant improvement in 802.11g performance. It's funny. Spuds also says, the higher up you can get the antenna, the better. That works up to a point. I've noticed the 802.11n doesn't seem to deal particularly well with floors. With our 802.11g router, we had it in the basement. It covered the entire house except for one corner. 802.11n didn't work very well unless you were sort of in the spear around where the 802.11n antenna was. And I also say it's different people's buildings. The materials can have a dramatic impact on the performance of 802.11n. So, I would post us your thoughts on 802.11n, 802.11n antenna hacking mods, because there's certainly some out there. Whether you figured out how to add external 802.11n antennas to boost or replace the internal MIMO antennas in your router, email us, twitch@twit.tv. We definitely would.
Indeed.
Brian's got problems. He's feeling pain.
Stutter. I think it was his last week of the week before we talked about stutter on video playback and Intel chipsets. It's something I don't think either of us were very familiar with. I just wanted to include this in here. Okay. Brian mentions the 24 hertz bug in Intel chipsets causes a stutter every 40 seconds. Australia, like the UK where I live, uses PAL, not NTSC. And not only do we have our native DVDs, which are 25p 50i, but we can play NTSC discs, which are 29.97p 59.94i, and Blu-rays, which are mostly 23.976. These are all frame rates. Depending on what playback software you're using, I know MPCHC, which Media Player Classic, can. You get to an auto change, the monitor frequency, or just some hotkeys to launch scripts to do the same thing. If you run your PC at 24 hertz and watch PAL video, it stutters every couple of minutes rather than every 40 seconds. I don't know how improved that is necessarily. I guess I didn't realize that this was a very specific bug on Intel's integrated graphics chip that they had an issue with the 24 hertz.
Basically, you can't do 24 frames per second.
Yeah.
Properly.
Without choking.
We should get Robert Heron on to talk about this because he's sort of the master of being irritated with Intel as far as this goes. It's a definite issue. They know about it. They seem to be taking their time on fixing it. And it's really frustrating. Go buy a video card. Go buy a proper video card.
Right.
Is the cold, you know, maybe Intel's just not into 20. Maybe Intel wants 24p playback to die. That could also be a... that could also be an entirely plausible response.
Nice.
Novel has an interesting question. She has, he has a GTX 560 Ti. He uses to feed Netflix to a TV in another room via HDMI for the kids. Meanwhile, I would like to game on the computer while the kids watch a movie in the other room. My problem is that when I enable dual monitor and send the stream to the TV, all the other PC sounds, including what you're doing, like his game audio or her game audio, get fed to the TV as well. I need to be able to send only Netflix and its audio to the TV and everything else in my headset, which is plugged into the onboard sound card from my Asus P6T motherboard, which I have. In essence, I have two audio devices, GPU and motherboard, but it seems that one overrides the other. How can I achieve this? I'm running Windows 7 64-bit. Thanks. I don't know if you can. It's an interesting thought. Could you? I don't know of an application, and I also haven't looked for an application recently that allowed you to define which audio feed went to. If you could select a single audio feed out of all the audio things going on your computer to HDMI, and it's a hard one because normally I would think with Blu-ray playback, you just get the Blu-ray playback, not the other system noise. Background. So it can be done. I'm just not sure how you would do it.
I don't know if it can. I don't know if it can be done because of the way Windows 7 or Windows audio driver works. There is one potential option. If you look at an application called Virtual Audio Cable, and what it allows you to do, it's a Windows WDM multimedia driver that allows a user to transfer audio streams from one application to another. It doesn't exactly do what he's saying. I think Windows has an ability to output two different streams to two different components. That's why he's seeing these mixes, right? You can output all of your audio through HDMI or all of your audio through like your headphones or speakers near there. Let's see. It says that any application is able to send an audio stream. Now, I don't think Virtual Audio Cable is going to do actually what they want to do. I don't think that they're... I don't know. If anybody in the chat room has an idea, let us know.
Because you're actually trying to associate any sounds from a particular browser with...
True.
With an HDMI output. So that alone... Like, I look at this, like, associate browser with HDMI output. It's a very specific problem. It's a very Netflix problem. Actually, it's any streaming video service. I was like, oh, Google Chrome browser. No, Google Chrome browser just has a feed labeled HDMI, not an HDMI.
You know, if you go into your application and you can specify the audio output, specifically in the application, maybe you'll have that capability. I mean, your browser, I don't think, is going to have that option. So you might be kind of screwed there. But, you know, if you look at Windows Media Player or Media Player Classic, those do tend to let you specify what the specific output is. And my experience has been that if you do not select the device that is default when in Windows, that it's not really going to work anyway. Yeah, I don't think the Windows audio driver audio software stack kind of works in a way where you'll be able to split these audio inputs to different devices. I will solicit the audience of This Week in Computer Hardware again to tell us we are incorrect, because I think this is something that could be very useful to a lot of people, right? That way you could have one computer serving multiple uses. It sounds like a good idea. I just don't think it's likely possible. Sorry.
If there are any Microsoft engineers listening in the audience today, please.
Please let us know. We have an email from Tony about GPU upgrades. He says, I regularly listen to the podcast. Thank you. And found it when I was looking to upgrade my system last time. And since you are all over the hardware scene, I was hoping you could help me with a question. I'm currently running a 2-plus-year-old system with the following specs. Core i7-920, ASUS P6T motherboard, 6 gigs of memory, and ASUS GTX 295, which for people who don't remember is a dual GTX 270-ish graphics card, 270s. It's a 2 GPUs on 1 PCB board. He has 2 1-terabyte hard drives and a striped RAID array, 24-inch monitor, 850-watt power supply. He's a fan of the Battlefield series and is eagerly anticipating Battlefield 3. Apparently, based on our email account, a lot of people are eagerly anticipating Battlefield 3. He says he is a bit worried about the ability of his system to play at a decent graphics level. So the questions are, does he buy a whole new system? Does he upgrade the GPU? And if so, what would we recommend? Does he overclock everything and pray he doesn't fry something? You know, my first thought on this is that hardware is more than capable of playing Battlefield 3. A GTX 295 is probably still a pretty good card. If you've got a bottleneck somewhere, that's probably going to end up being is your GPU. And I hate saying that because that was probably a $600 video card when he bought it. But these things happen in the world of, I know, these things happen in the world of graphics hardware. Maybe I'm going to assume he got it used. Maybe it was a really good deal for $150 or something. You know, if you buy a single GTX 580, you're going to be in the clear. You're going to be able to play anything. If your 24-inch monitor is 1920 by 1200, you're going to be able to play Battlefield 3 pretty much maxed out at GTX 580 without a doubt. Maybe even GTX 570. The best thing you can probably do is not spend any money right now. Wait for the game to come out. Wait for some articles, some other users to talk about the performance of Battlefield 3 on different levels of hardware, and then make your purchasing decision. Right? There's no sense. I always tend to go for that wait until you have to do it mentality. That's why we don't tell people to like buy upgrades in pieces, you know, save that money instead and then buy all at once. Same idea here. You know, wait till Battlefield 3 comes out. If you can't play it at the settings you want to play it at, you're going to have to suffer for a couple of days while the one you order in from Newegg or Tiger Director or NCIX or wherever it is comes in, but you will have made sure you needed to make that investment. I think that's still a pretty substantial system.
I hope so, because I'm running that CPU at home right now.
Yeah, I mean, also, the CPU is definitely going to be able to do it.
I would like to nominate PCPer for the PCPer.com/battlefield hardware guide or hardware list. You should test every processor made in the last 5 years and its Battlefield performance.
Wow. Wow. I also nominate PC Perspective to have hire 5 new people tomorrow to accomplish such a goal. But I think it's a good idea. I think that's something we want to kind of look at. Hopefully we'll be able to do that.
What is the oldest system you can comfortably play Battlefield 3 on? Oh, that could be just horrible.
Comfort level is where it all changes, though.
640 by 480. Not my gaming choice.
Nope.
Jan says, I got a question from a colleague yesterday who basically stated he might need a second identical monitor for his photo editing. Not a big deal. However, we're talking 30-inch monitor here. Do you have a recommendation for a card to drive that? Is any card featuring dual-link DVI basically okay, or what would you watch out for in a photoshopping box? Doesn't make any 3D stuff. How much difference does signal quality or 2D performance really make? I would also say photo editing, color accuracy, and the ability to calibrate the monitor can have a huge impact. It depends on the person doing the photo editing. A lot of people happily labor away at their photos in complete and total lack of any calibration of their monitors. They're happy. Other people, you know, have special hooded monitors that contain ambient light from interacting with their carefully calibrated $5,000 high-end, totally color accurate monitor.
Yep.
Is any card featuring dual link DVI pretty much fine? I mean, Photoshop, yeah. Is Photoshop doing any acceleration on cards?
So Photoshop does, if you get CS4, CS5, it does do some acceleration, but it does it through OpenGL. So any graphics card is going to be able to take advantage of those accelerations, you know, Radeon 4000, 5000, 6000, GeForce, you know, what are we at now? 500s and 400s. There were no 300s. So 500s, 400s, and 200s should be just fine. In terms of the color calibration, one recommendation is to look at the my favorite device for that is the Pantone Huey device, H-U-E-Y. It's like $100, and it will calibrate. If this guy is a photo editor and he's going to multiple monitors for the first time, if you just buy a second monitor and you turn it on and you drag an image back and forth between them, he's going to be disgusted at the color difference, even if he doesn't know which one's supposed to be correct. It's just. It's going to be obviously apparent. For $99, you can fix that problem regardless of what video cards you have. But any graphics card that has two dual link DVI outputs on it, which is going to be the strong majority of cards today, will be able to support two 30-inch monitors. And you know, for Photoshop acceleration, you don't need a whole lot of processing power to take advantage of that OpenGL acceleration. I'm thinking if you have any 5700 or 5800 or 6700 or 6800 series card from AMD, you're going to be perfectly fine. And if you have, you know, anything like GTX 460 or above or GTX 560 or above, you're going to be perfectly fine. You're going to be able to max out any of the performance benefits you would get with those graphics cards and be able to take advantage of dual monitors. Now, if you think you might want to go three, then maybe look at the AMD Radeon HD 5000 and 6000 series cards, because almost all of those cards will support at least three displays, some of them up to six displays. So if you think it's something that he's going to be addicted to and going to want to expand past that, which right. I am guilty of, to keep in mind.
One thing I forgot to mention, Tony's talk about GPU upgrades for his Core i7-920 and his, you know, soon to be massive Battlefield 3 addiction.
Yes.
Overclocking everything and pray I don't fry something. I love overclocking. But I find overclocking never yields as much power as I think it should for the effort that went into it.
Right.
You know, so I just wanted to say, like, you know, if you want to experiment with overclocking, by all means, maybe it'll make everything better for you. But, you know, if you're worried about your hardware, feel free to avoid overclocking, even though it's actually almost impossible to kill most modern hardware through overclocking, unless you get out of control with the voltage. But hopefully you don't do that.
Agreed.
Steve says, I listen to the show every week while I do my 300-kilometer commute each weekend. That's a hike, dude. I'm about to build a system using a Z68 motherboard, DDR3 RAM, and an i5-2500K CPU. He says, Ryan, recently I think you mentioned it is better to populate three RAM slots on a triple-channel system. If I heard this right, would three 2-gigabyte modules be better than two 4-gigabyte modules, given they are roughly around the same price? You know, first of all, it doesn't really matter because your Z68 motherboard is Sandy Bridge, which does not support triple channel.
Correct.
Which, as I noted in the show notes to myself, makes me really happy because I own three sticks of pricey memory for my Core i7-920. Would there be any advantage to going with, you know, if you say you want to do 8 gigabytes of memory, should you do 2 4-gigabytes or, you know, 4 2-gigabytes? Or should you, you know, what's the general rule of thumb for Z68 motherboard, Z68 memory slot coverage?
In previous generation chipsets and motherboards, there were potential performance detriments to filling all the memory slots on the motherboard using all four slots as opposed to two. That has pretty much gone away now. I don't hesitate at all to tell people to fill up all the memory slots on their motherboard as long as, you know, it's on, like, especially on a Sandy Bridge platform. I don't think, you know, if you're going to overclock the memory, you might limit what you can do there. But if you're installing DDR3 1600 or DDR3 1333 memory, you're not going to notice any speed difference with four DIMMs than you are two. Now, that being said, the benefit of doing dual 4-gig modules instead of quad 2-gig modules is that you leave yourself more room to upgrade down the road if you want to. You know, you can always take those four or those two 4-gigabyte modules to another system and add four more, or I'm sorry, add two more modules, right, to fill out four, maybe get 16 gigs of memory if that's something you want to do. But if you find, you know, a really, really good deal on four 2-gigabyte modules, I don't see any problem with that, and I wouldn't tell anybody not to do that. I tend to like the keeping my options open in the future type mentality, so I would, you know, if it's like 10, 15 bucks more, I would go with the two 4-gig modules, that type of thing, just because it leaves things open a little bit in the future. And just in case maybe these were different issues, his Z68 build versus the question of 2 gigs versus or 2 channels versus 3 channels. Maybe he had a separate system. I just will say, let's say you're using an X58 platform that does use triple channel memory like Patrick's Core i7-920 system. Would it be better to have 3 2-gigabyte modules or 2 4-gigabyte modules? Thereby, you know, triple channel at 6 gigs or dual channel at 8 gigs. And in that case, I would say it almost completely depends on what you're doing. If what you're doing is memory heavy, as in it's going to use a lot of memory, something like Photoshop, something like Adobe Premiere, I would go with the more memory option. It's something that requires lower memory latency, maybe also like Adobe Premiere, but not Photoshop. There's not a whole lot of stuff that can really utilize 3 channels. In my estimation, in my experience, having more memory is usually better than going from 2 to 3 channels, which kind of explains why Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge are using 2-channel memory controllers rather than 3-channel memory controllers. There wasn't a huge amount of performance benefits in that regard. So, but who knows? Maybe I'll be eating my words there when Sandy Bridge E comes out and has 4-channel memory controllers.
I don't think you're in too much danger there.
Yeah.
I don't think that much danger there at all. What's coming up on PC for this week, Ryan?
Other than our continued engagement into this world of this new overclocking world, or I'm sorry, new benchmarking world with video capture devices and these types of things, we are also going to be taking a look at gaming performance on a couple of new graphics cards. We're going to look at some Deus Ex performance, maybe see how that performs and different things. We're also going to be playing with the first NVIDIA graphics card that supports 5 displays on a single card, which is it's the first for an NVIDIA card. Obviously, AMD cards can do it, but the Galaxy has a new card out that will do 5 displays off of a single GPU, and that should be pretty interesting and see what kind of configurations we can screw around with on that card as well. How about on Techzilla? What do you guys got planned this week while you are up in Oregon?
Getting a little mobile heavy on Monday. We're going to be basically doing app radio from Pioneer. We're doing a bunch of iPhone accessories. Doc Popular is going to come on to talk about taking better pictures with your cell phone, regardless of what species of operating system it uses. So that's kind of our next big show coming up. And I'm working on a set-top box roundup, which may kill me. It is one of those things where as soon as you sort of like come to a consensus, somebody releases a firmware update and everything becomes much better or much worse.
yes.
But a lot of asking when the Google TVs hit $99. A lot of people are like, now's the time to buy. Can I buy it now? Can I buy it now? Because all things that are Google must be awesome. So I am going to, and my apologies to everyone watching, call it for tonight because I have to be up at 6 a.m. and driving.
Understandable.
Back to the range, and it is going to be an unpleasant wake-up call. But
let's make sure to remind everybody to email us twitch@twit.tv. Send us your questions, send us any ideas you have, topics you might want us to cover or discuss or look at a little bit further. twitch@twit.tv. We live on your questions. We love to see them in. And it looks like I might be actually potentially in Petaluma next week, Patrick. I don't know if you'll be back in town yet. I'll be in San Francisco. Trying to figure out whether or not I can get up to the studio or not, but
well, maybe I can drive you up to the studio.
All right. Well, we will work that out. Maybe next week we'll have a great episode, both from the studio again.
That would be freaking awesome, dude. That is it for this week's Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.